Running a business is no cakewalk, but with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is experience. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com. Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Before AI can help your business predict demand, accelerate growth, inform decisions, automate tasks, reveal insights, generate content, you have to trust it. Introducing WatsonX Governance, helping you govern any AI as data, models, and policies change so you can scale it responsibly. Let's create AI that begins with trust with WatsonX Governance. Learn more at ibm.com/governance. IBM, let's create.
Welcome to Tech Stuff, a production from iHeartRadio. Hey there, and welcome to Tech Stuff. I'm your host, Jonathan Strickland. I'm an executive producer with iHeartRadio, and how the tech are ya? You know, when I was a kid, we called applications programs, or sometimes we called them software, but mainly we called them programs. Heck, it's what the digital characters in the film Tron referred to one another as. They would say, "Greetings, program." But then again, when I was a kid, hardly anyone even had a computer. If you did have a computer, you know, it was its own device. It was air-gapped because there was no such thing as a public internet yet. I mean, maybe if you were working with, you know, ARPANET or something, you had a system that was connected, but most of us didn't. Also, when I was a kid, a movie ticket was $4 and Disney World was just the Magic Kingdom. Also, I had to walk to school and it was uphill both ways and, you know, you get the drift. But then things change, right? For instance, Disney went ahead and built 3 other theme parks at Disney World and movie tickets got way more expensive. And we also started calling programs applications. And something else would emerge that would change programming, the rise of the application programming interface or API. So we're doing a Tech Stuff tidbits about what APIs are and where they come from. Now, to be clear, the actual concept of the API is quite old. It comes from way before my time. So arguably, you could say the earliest work that would evolve into what would later be called an API actually started back in the 1940s. But the reason is because you had all these different teams around the world making computer systems. These systems were kind of, you know, they were independent. They weren't interoperable. They weren't compatible. So there were people who saw the need to create tools that would allow for at least some interoperability. Otherwise, you're really limiting innovation, right? If you've got a brilliant programmer, a brilliant developer who has come up with this great idea for a computer program, but they're only familiar with one computer system, you've really limited the utility of that program, at least until someone who is familiar with a different computer system can come along and then perhaps port that program to other systems. So there was the recognition of a need to create sort of a common ground that could work across different computer systems. The actual term for API, at least a version of this term, because back then it was called application program interface rather than programming, shows up in a paper that was titled Data Structures and Techniques for Remote Computer Graphics. It was written by Ira W. Cotton and Frank S. Greatorex, which might be the best surname I've ever seen, Greatorex. Anyway, the paper describes the technology needed to allow for, quote, providing a remotely accessed interactive computer graphics system, end quote. So, not an API as we would understand it today, at least not the kind of API we typically talk about when you see something about APIs in the tech news these days. The authors were seeking to create a sort of common ground that programmers could depend upon so they wouldn't have to worry about the underlying hardware. Because, like I said, the underlying hardware was often unique to a specific system. Sometimes, even the same computer company might make different models that are inherently incompatible with one another, which means you would have to relearn everything in order to develop for the new platform. So yeah, an application programming interface was kind of an approach to sort of create almost like a universal translator just for computer systems, not for people, but for computer systems, so that programmers wouldn't have to specialize in something and potentially end up becoming obsolete themselves, right? If you were a programmer and you tied yourself down to a specific type of computer, and let's say that that computer company goes out of business, you would have all this knowledge and expertise that was sunk into something that no longer was relevant. That would be disastrous on your part. You would have to start all over again. So APIs could help create a method for creating bridging material between computer systems. In 1974, which is still technically before my time, only by a little bit, a paper by C.J. Date titled The Relational and Network Approaches Comparison of the Application Programming Interface would not only add ing to programs, so now we got application programming interface, this paper also expanded the concept of an API, in this case involving databases. So not just computer systems now, now we're talking about databases and ways to be able to create a bridging material so that you could access different databases through the same application. This led to the American National Standards Institute, as well as the Standards Planning and Requirements Committee, to define and adopt API for database management systems. What happened next was that programmers and computer scientists began to develop APIs for all sorts of computational tasks. You know, we had seen it for database management, and we would see it for other stuff too. These APIs would support different programming languages so that programmers could make use of the API without worrying about which programming language they needed to use when they were creating the program. Because not all programmers are fluent in every programming language. They typically specialize in a couple. In turn, the API would become, as Carl Malamud put it, a way to make, quote, a set of services available to a programmer for performing certain tasks, end quote, which seems vague in general, but that was on purpose, right? It wasn't meant to pigeonhole API for specific uses, but rather making it an umbrella term for a way of allowing developers to access a set of services that were well-suited for performing certain tasks. It was all about kind of removing some of the challenges to programming, right? That whole thing about let's not reinvent the wheel, that's kind of what API was all about, was creating these sort of standardized approaches so that programmers could really focus on making better programs with a shorter development process that, and not have to, you know, worry about reinvention all the time. Now, I would argue that the types of APIs that we typically talk about today really originate from a dissertation that was made by a guy named Roy Fielding while he was pursuing his PhD. He called his dissertation architectural styles and the design of network-based software architectures. Now, that title doesn't scream API, right? If I just saw that title listed on a citation list, I wouldn't immediately think, oh, that's a paper about APIs. But it is, actually. And Fielding also presented ideas about how APIs work in the age of the internet. So he wrote this dissertation in 2000. At that time, there was an emerging technology that would shape the web and later the mobile internet, and that was the web API, or the WebAPI, as I would prefer to call it, but then no one would know what I was talking about, so I won't do that again. But in 2000, that same year, Salesforce would release what a lot of folks would point to as the first modern API. In fact, we even have a precise date for this, which is unusual when I'm talking about the history of stuff. Often, you can't nail it down to even a specific year, but in this case, we have a specific day, February 7th, 2000. That's because Salesforce actually unveiled this API during the IDG Demo 2000 conference. The Salesforce API allowed its customers, and Salesforce's customers are other companies, right? Like, you typically have small businesses that are customers of Salesforce, and they are essentially offloading certain business needs to Salesforce. Well, in this case, the API would allow these businesses to create an ecosystem in which the businesses could share data across their different applications. So, you know, a business can be really, really complicated, right? You can have all these different departments. You can have each department having its own systems, you know, dedicated for that department, which is cool, but it also means that you have the danger of each department becoming a silo so that you can't easily share information from department to department. And that can really end up inhibiting innovation and advancements, and it can be a big hit on efficiency. So what Salesforce was doing was releasing this API where its customers could make use of this and be able to share across different applications all the same information and make better tools that would allow for these businesses to operate more efficiently and effectively. And that would be a better end experience for the user. And that philosophy would become sort of an underlying element, a foundational element for APIs moving forward. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I'll explain a bit more about how this would develop over the following years. Running a business is no cakewalk. There is a ton to keep track of. Employees to keep happy, spending to control, travel to plan, and on top of it all, nobody knows exactly what the future holds. Your finance team always has to be ready to change. But with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is, experience. And you can finally say goodbye to the costly mistakes and risks that come from manual work and spreadsheets. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com. Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
I'm Katya Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Before AI can help your business predict demand, accelerate growth, inform decisions, automate tasks, reveal insights, generate content, you have to trust it. Introducing Watson X Governance, helping you govern any AI as data, models, and policies change so you can scale it responsibly. Let's create AI that begins with trust with Watson X Governance. Learn more at ibm.com/governance. IBM, let's create.
Okay, we're back. So not too long after Salesforce launched its API, like, you know, half a year later, a little more than half a year, eBay would follow suit. It launched its API in November of 2000. This would let licensed eBay partners access a framework that would allow the developers to incorporate eBay services into other websites. And technically, it would also allow it for applications as well. So now, like, if you were a licensed eBay partner, you could incorporate some of eBay's functionality into your own website. This was a pretty limited version of the API in the sense that you had to be a licensed partner first, and that was not the easiest thing to do. So it was limited in the number of organizations that could make use of the API. But the concept was a strong one. Amazon would follow behind in 2002, and it launched its own API, as well as it launched Amazon Web Services. Now, this was not the fully fledged Amazon Web Services we would talk about today. That would happen a few years later when we would get introduction of a couple of other big tools, but it was the beginning of a massive move for Amazon, one of the most profitable moves that Amazon would ever make. But if you were a developer, this meant you could actually include Amazon functionality on, say, your webpage. And this would give people a chance to search for products and do some window shopping right from the comfort of your webpage. Maybe you even have your webpage show off products that you're talking about or that are related to whatever the webpage is focused on, that kind of thing. And it meant that by incorporating that directly into your webpage, people could access that stuff without leaving your site, you know, and your bounce rate would go down and your engagement rate would go way up. Now, it would take a couple more years for other companies to really push into API development. It was a little slow. These companies were pioneers, and others took a bit of time to kind of catch up. For one thing, you have to remember, like 2000, 2001, that's when we're talking about the dot-com bubble bursting, especially in the wake of 9/11 here in the United States. And so that would end up taking a lot of the wind out of the sails of companies that otherwise were innovating in the web space. So that, I think, slowed down API development. But one of the things we did see in the mid-2000s was the emergence of widgets, which were largely possible because of APIs. Do y'all remember widgets? I mean, they're still technically a thing. It's not like they went away. It's just they were really being pushed really hard in the mid to late 2000s on everything from early social media platforms to really, like, I remember seeing them everywhere at CES, right? You would see a refrigerator and it would have widgets, or a television and it had widgets. Everything had widgets on them. And they were always these little icons that linked to some sort of basic functionality, right? It was usually very specific. Like, it might be a weather report widget. So you could get a very quick rundown on what current and predicted weather conditions are or were going to be. Or it might be a stock ticker, or it could be a news headline ticker. You get the idea. It was very specific and purpose-built, and it was largely thanks to APIs that it was possible, right? The widgets were typically tapping into some other platform's information and then presenting that information to you in the form of the widget. In 2004, Flickr introduced its API that gave people the chance to embed their images that they had been storing on Flickr on other platforms, including things like web pages or social media. That was incredible, right? You could have Flickr act as your repository of images, and then you could use the embed feature to share those images on other platforms without having to upload the same picture to all the different places you wanted. And it really streamlined things. And it really pushed Flickr into becoming a leader for online images for quite some time because they really got ahead of things. In 2006, we had a couple of big APIs that emerged. One came from Twitter, you know, rest in peace. I guess, you know, we could refer to it as X now, but it was Twitter back then. And Facebook, they both introduced APIs in 2006. And this gave developers a chance to tap into the functionality of those platforms in new ways. And that's kind of what led to third-party Twitter feed readers, for example, like TweetDeck. In fact, TweetDeck became so useful and popular that Twitter actually acquired it, and now it belongs to X. And honestly, I'm curious now what it's called, because I imagine it's not called TweetDeck within X anymore, since they got rid of all the Twitter and tweet stuff. And I didn't look it up, so I don't know. I no longer access TweetDeck because it's behind a paywall. But yeah, so developers were able to add in new functions in these new services that tapped into these platforms. And they were functions that you wouldn't find on the vanilla version of the service. So for example, let's talk about Twitter and TweetDeck. With TweetDeck, a user could create a single view that would incorporate multiple Twitter accounts separated by columns. So if you were someone like me, you would have one column that would just show you the incoming Twitter feed, like all the posts from the folks that you follow. You could have a column that shows your own personal Twitter messages, as well as the replies and quotes and that kind of stuff. So all the engagement with your own Twitter messages. A third column might show, say, your podcasts, tweets and replies and stuff. So it's the same thing as your own personal account, but for your podcast account and so on. Like, you could have multiple columns stretching across the screen, each one focusing on something separate on Twitter, but all incorporated into a single view. So you have a very easy way to monitor this. This was really useful for social media managers, right? Who might be monitoring multiple accounts. Let's say that you're a manager and you have several clients. You could have a tweet deck set up with all the different client columns there. And in a one view, you can quickly see what's going on. It's such a useful suite of features that Twitter would buy it. And now Elon Musk has locked it behind a paywall. You have to be a subscriber to access those features. So, yeah, bummer. It's why I don't really check TechStuff's Twitter feed anymore, because I had it incorporated into TweetDeck, and now I can't access TweetDeck because I'm not a subscriber. So, yeah, it's kind of lost. I could technically log into X in TechStuff's account and check it that way, but y'all, it's just... The mental energy needed for me to do that just doesn't exist in me. Anyway, Facebook's API would let developers create all sorts of stuff that could be built on top of Facebook, including things like games and surveys and all that sort of stuff. This is what eventually led to the Cambridge Analytica scandal, in fact, because a developer created a survey tool that was paying people to take the survey. But what the people didn't know is that by agreeing to the survey, which was all based, you know, integrated into Facebook using Facebook's API, then the actual survey could gather information, not just about the person taking the survey in the first place, but all the people they connected to through Facebook. Like, if their friends had public Facebook profiles, the app could then access all of that information as well. So that's what led to a big scandal, because it meant that the app developer was able to access information from people who never consented to share that information in the first place. Facebook ultimately changed its API to restrict apps so that they could only request access to info that was relevant to whatever the app was doing. So that way, if you were to download or install an app that was like a fun horoscope app, it wasn't for some reason getting access to like all your messages and stuff like that. That would not be necessary for that particular app. But back in the old days, there were fewer restrictions, and we saw what happened as a result of that. In 2007, We had another huge development that would have a big push on APIs, and that was the introduction of the iPhone. So I've said this before, the iPhone was not the world's first smartphone. It had followed behind lots of other smartphones. But before the iPhone, particularly here in the United States, smartphones were not really a consumer product. They were sort of a prosumer product. It was the kind of thing you would expect a business executive to own, like a BlackBerry, something like those types of smartphones. But your average person didn't have a smartphone. That's not how they accessed the web. If they were accessing the web at all, they were doing so on a desktop or laptop computer. Maybe a web TV if they were one of those folks. But otherwise, you were accessing it on like a computer. The iPhone would change that, right? And that would mark the beginning of what would become a massive shift in web development and web design. This migration to the mobile web. As more people adopted smartphones, there was this need to make it easier for those folks to view and interact with online content, right? Like, you couldn't just present a web page to a smartphone the same way you would to a PC or laptop, because the landscape was totally different, right? The size of the screen was different. It would make it very challenging to read or interact with stuff that was on a web page. You had to come about it in a different way. But that also meant that there were new opportunities to develop applications that were built on top of APIs that could work specifically for smartphones, that could lay things out in a way that made it easier to interact with the content that was on the web. So the mobile web really created a huge, huge change in the approach to APIs. And there was another one that was going on at the same time, and that was the shift to the cloud. This was happening more in the background, but you had more and more companies that were taking advantage of cloud services in order to offload things that traditionally would have to all happen in-house, right? So in the old days, if you had a company that had its own like databases and computer systems and stuff, you had to keep all of that stuff on premises. You were responsible for keeping up with all the hardware, maintaining the software, updating features, that sort of stuff. That's a lot of work. But cloud services offloaded a lot of that and really made it possible for software as a service to emerge. I'll talk a little bit more about that in just a second. We're going to take another quick break and we'll be right back. Running a business is no cakewalk. There is a ton to keep track of. Employees to keep happy, spending to control, travel to plan, and on top of it all, nobody knows exactly what the future holds. Your finance team always has to be ready to change. But with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is, experience. And you can finally say goodbye to the costly mistakes and risks that come from manual work and spreadsheets. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com. Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
I'm Katya Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Before AI can help your business predict demand, accelerate growth, inform decisions, automate tasks, reveal insights, generate content, you have to trust it. Introducing Watson X Governance, helping you govern any AI as data, models, and policies change so you can scale it responsibly. Let's create AI that begins with trust with Watson X Governance. Learn more at ibm.com/governance. IBM, let's create.
So yeah, I mentioned before the break, the emergence of cloud services. Now, they did exist before the mid-2000s, but it was right around that time where they started to really take off. And in fact, we could point to 2006 as being a huge year for that, because that's, again, when Amazon would introduce some new features in the cloud, like Amazon Compute and Amazon Storage Services, that would become hugely influential in the space. In fact, it made Amazon become the dominant player in the cloud computing space in many ways. So now you had the ability for businesses to tap into functionalities that otherwise they would have to develop all in-house, and it might take them years to do, or it might be such a big investment that they never would be able to do it. Now, by becoming customers of these cloud computing companies, they could end up offloading the compute and storage stuff to another company and get their developers to create new applications that tapped into that ability and leverage the information that the business was gathering. So it became possible to create entirely new services. And this is really when we started to see software as a service explode as a business model, because developers could create a tool that would meet the needs of their customers and then charge their customers, maybe even setting up a subscription service for their software. And that would turn an application into an ongoing revenue generator. Like in the old days, let's say you made a word processing program, you would sell that in stores and you would get a portion of every sale that was made, right? That was the old days of programming. You would make a program, people would buy a copy of the program, you hope that not too many people pirated your stuff, and you made money. Software as a service is totally different. You would make an application, and you would sell access to that application, which would be based in the cloud, built on APIs, tapping into all these powerful other platforms, and your customers would pay you an ongoing subscription fee to access that tool. And you would be able to make money off the same application with the same customer over and over again, as opposed to doing it that one time in that one point of sale. So it really was a truly enormous change in business. These days, APIs allow developers to make tons of new products and services by building on various foundations. Typically, the developers are also paying for the use of APIs. I mean, it depends. The platform may have a tiered list of API access, with a free tier at the bottom, which might limit the features that developers can tap into, or maybe a charge based upon how frequently the app that the developer is working on is going to reference the underlying platform. So when we say reference, what we're talking about is the app itself, the end app. How frequently does it have to access the underlying platform? So if you've built a Twitter-based app, for example, or X, I guess we should say, an X-based app, how frequently is that app referencing X? How many times does it have to pull information from or post information to the underlying platform? That would be a reference. And one way that companies will charge developers is by adding up the number of times their apps are referencing the underlying platform and saying, all right, you are putting X demand on this platform. Shouldn't use X since that is a platform. You're putting this specific amount of demand upon our platform. In turn, we are going to charge you this amount because you are putting this load on us in order to power your application. So this has actually led to some issues recently, which I've talked about on this show, but you've probably also just heard, you know, out and about, which is that a couple of different companies, specifically X, formerly known as Twitter, and Reddit, have alienated some developers by changing up their API. So by doing things like getting rid of free tiers of service and hiking up the cost of other tiers, these companies have really upset a lot of developers and users. So these companies are charging developers based on essentially how frequently the apps are referencing those underlying platforms. So Reddit is a great example. Reddit did this thing where they changed how much they were charging developers for really popular apps. So let's say that you've made a Reddit app, and really this, let's just say this app is just a way to browse and post to Reddit, right? We're not reinventing the wheel. We're not making anything spectacular. What we're making is a Reddit tool that lets you, you know, access subreddits, read posts, and make posts, and that's it. But it's got a really good user interface. It's really well organized, easy to use. It's attractive. It's got, you know, things in places that make a lot of sense, and a lot of users see it as being superior to the official Reddit app. So they gravitate toward this third-party app that you have developed because they just like the way that you've approached this. But your app has become really, really popular, and people are using it a lot. It's not just that a ton of people have downloaded and installed your app. It's that they're on the app all the time. And so your app is referencing Reddit a lot every single day. Reddit is tallying up those references, and then it sends you a bill. And that bill is truly massive. Like, we're talking like millions of dollars a year, massive. And meanwhile, your app is not really generating that much revenue. Like, maybe you built this app and maybe you are making some money off of it, but it's nothing compared to the bill that's coming in. So you literally cannot afford to stay in business because the bill you have to pay to Reddit is greater than what you're making in revenue. So you have to shut down. This is what happened over at Reddit. Some very popular Reddit third-party apps had to close up shop because they couldn't afford to stay in business. And a lot of the Reddit community got extremely upset about this and felt that Reddit was pricing out third-party developers and trying to force people into using the actual Reddit app, which a lot of people did not like. And as a result, we saw lots of protests on Reddit. Subreddits went dark for a couple of days, some longer than just a couple of days. Now, there's this ugly business of Reddit coming in and removing moderators of certain subreddits who were refusing to give up on protesting this change. And it's continuing to this day. It's still ugly. There are still some subreddits that are feeling the effects of this. The leadership at Reddit haven't really budged on the issue. And meanwhile, the users are just as angry now as they were earlier this summer when the changes were first kind of coming to light. So APIs can be a big, big deal, right? They can be a big revenue generator. They can be a big way to build loyalty in a customer base, but they can also be at the heart of great controversy if a company decides to make changes to its policies and, at least in the eyes of the public, disproportionately hurt the developers who are making use of those APIs. So I hope this episode helps clear up what APIs are, what they're for, and why they are important. They are the thing, the gateway that allows independent developers to tap into the massive features that are found in really important platforms, and to create new experiences for people that we have. If I were to do an episode just on a list of apps that companies bought because the apps that were developed by third parties were better than the stuff that was coming directly out of the company itself, that would be an epic episode because there are countless versions of that. And it really just shows that, you know, innovation is not something that you can just contain within four walls. Innovation comes from entire communities and people who are only tangentially connected to the actual underlying, you know, thing. And it's much better to allow that kind of innovation to flourish, because we get the best tools and best experiences that way. And I don't think it really profits anyone for locking that down too much. I mean, I get the need to generate revenue to an extent, but I feel like the extent we have seen has far outstretched credulity, let's say. In other words, I don't necessarily believe it when Reddit says that they have to put in these exorbitant fees in order to pay their internet bills. I don't know that that's really that. I'm sure there's some truth to that, but I don't know that it necessitates charging a developer millions of dollars a year because their app is so popular. I hope you are all well. I hope you enjoyed this Tech Stuff Tidbits episode, and I will talk to you again really soon. Tech Stuff is an iHeartRadio production. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. Running a business is no cakewalk, but with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is experience. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com.
I'm Katya Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
With the new Dexcom G7, you can achieve better diabetes results without painful fingersticks. It sends your glucose numbers to your compatible phone or watch so you can always see where you are and where you're heading. See how food and exercise affects your glucose, making it easier to spend more time in range and lower your A1C. Take more control of your diabetes with the number one recommended CGM brand. It's easy to get started today at Dexcom.com. That's Dexcom.com.
Dexcom data on file 2023. If your glucose alerts and readings from the G7 do not match symptoms or expectations, use a blood glucose meter to make diabetes treatment decisions. For a list of compatible devices, visit Dexcom.com/compatibility.